Are you able to speak, Greg?
I am. Hi, Bob.
Very good. You're there. Okay, people. I'm just going to mute the other numbers right now. I don't know which one's Greg's. Just whistle for a second, Greg. Okay, so that's you, that one. Okay. All right. This is a special weekend. Good. Good. Very good.
What was that?
Your first giggle. This guy giggles a lot. This is Greg Duffel. It's appropriate on a religious weekend that we get one of the icons of our own Dobbstown religion. Greg did the highly ambiguous, ambivalent experience of running International Connection for many years, say about 2000 to 2009 or 10, somewhere in there. I know when Neufeldt was here, February 22nd, 2009, a few weeks before Ion showed up, unpredicted, unanticipated, we got on Greg's show, International Connection. He took it up from Bob Marshall and Wayne Morris. The CKM was shut down within a week after Neufeldt got on. I think that was 2009. Greg, did you stay on for a few more months or something, or were you already knocked? Was that it? I think that was it, right?
Well, can you hear me, Bob?
Yes, you're very clear.
Okay. What happened was that, as you may remember, we were removed twice from International Connection. We had that great honor. The first time, and both times...
Caused by Neufeldt.
The show before we were removed, what would have been our final show, somehow, Dave Neufeldt made an appearance when he had never made an appearance before.
Right.
And so the first time, it was in 2007, I think, and he was incensed, actually. The only reason he called in was he was incensed at what we were saying about you.
Is this the time when he was with me here on February 22nd, 2009, or earlier?
Earlier. This is in 2007.
Okay.
This would have been in October 2007. And we had said that we were going to run something that week. And he had interest in listening to that. I don't think Dave had any interest in ever listening to our show, and that's fine.
No.
But he had interest in listening to whatever we were going to put on. And I can't remember exactly what happened, but he was listening, and I guess we said something that he didn't like, and he phoned in. And he didn't really, I don't think he got angry with us on the air. We carried on a conversation. Maybe you were there too. I can't remember. But the very next week, we were removed.
That's right.
And,
yes.
And then we filed a lawsuit, of all things, to get a radio show back for which we were never paid any money for. And somehow we actually got back on the air for a period of time starting in late 2007, I guess. No, I think it was late 2007. I think we weren't.
Yeah, because I think you got knocked off in 2006. I remember that.
No,
year,
you're right.
2006.
It was in late 2006. You're right. And then we got back in late 2007, and we were on for just about another year and a bit. And it
just
that's so
the happened. February 22nd, 2009, when Neufeldt was
and
here.
Dave,
did he join?
Yeah. And then Dave Neufeldt came on, and we sort of joked. You know, we said, "Hey, the last time you were on, the next week we weren't on the air."
Yeah.
And sure enough, it happened again. For good. That was it. Until now. Until now.
Oh, is that Dan? Is that Dan you're calling?
Oh, you know my mother. My mother. Can I just stick to my mother for a minute? Does my mother call me from Victoria?
Hey, put her on the show. I always wanted to meet her.
Hello, Mom. Hello. I'm on a radio show right now.
Oh. Mom.
No. What? You'll let me go? Yeah, I can't.
Wow. That's huge.
Wow.
Who the heck is saying
wow? She's good about that. Yeah. So, Anyway, where was I?
Yeah, so your mother has been a constant refrain through your career on the radio for decades.
Yeah, as soon as I get on the air, we're on the internet with you, wherever we are, my mother phones.
You got to tell us fantastic details later.
Stay away from that dangerous man. So,
I'm a dangerous man, Carol, from a mother's point of view. A stalwart NDP Ontario. What?
Sorry?
I said stalwart NDP.
Yes, she is, I think.
But then what'd you say?
I tried to convince her not to be, but NDP is supposed to be the, just for those people who are listening that don't know what an NDP is, it's a, it was a party that had claimed at one point to be sort of a quasi-socialist party.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what it is now. There's very interesting developments here about that in provincially, because we're going into another election here. And
I'd like to hear that. Before we go into it, let's see, what else was there to say? Neufeld calls in on 2007 or so. He had not been on the air for 21 years. He was kicked off in July 86 from CKLN as news manager. So he had not been on the radio in 21 years. He calls in, and then he gets you guys knocked off. Then you get back on. Then he's here, February 22nd. We get on, and changes were indicated. But a week later, Dave was still here, and I got talking to JW, and he asked me, What is tactility about, Bob? What does the Android mean? He'd never asked me. He's a billionaire. He never asked me the things I told him about, but suddenly he did. And I said, yeah, and I explained it, and I said, why? And he says, well, I was talking to Warren Buffett. He was a friend of Warren Buffett, and Buffett had been telling him what a influence McLuhan had on him back in the 60s. And JW had heard me say McLuhan, but he didn't know anything about it. So that got into a whole new level of talking with JW. And then 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later, Ion showed up on March 18th. So Neufeld was part of that transition. You might have.
Well, that whole Ion thing happened after the demise, essentially, of the International Connection. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I would say that was symbolic. You guys weren't needed anymore. You had kept the ball going. You kept me on the radio for many years. I'd call in on Sunday, even though Daniel resented it the whole time, but he couldn't. You were, I guess, had more power than he did. So you.
Well, you had actually Daniel Becerra, who was my co-host on the program for quite a few years. He sort of strangely opted out of the program. Although sometimes I think he would come in. He kind of opted out, you know, without really going into detail. Yeah, he kind of quit. And, I mean, he'd help me out with things on occasion, but he wouldn't go in. And I was sort of doing the show alone. And for that latter portion from, you know, mid-2008 until early 2009, Bob was a regular phone-in participant on the show, sort of co-hosting with me from a remote location. I can't remember where you were at that time. I guess we're in New York. You're
now
again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
We got here in June 2008. So if you started before June, I was in New York. But then most of the 2008 last half, I was with you into February.
Yeah. So we were doing a lot of replaying a lot of the International Connection shows. But the Bob Dobbs Church of the Subgenius programs, we were replaying those at one time when we got bored with actually doing a show or found it impossible to do a program, and we were replaying a lot of Mae Brussel, and some people may know who Mae Brussel is. I'm sure the people who listen to your show do. And so it's been almost a decade since we did the program.
You've been on the air. This is your first time in 10 years.
Pretty much, about 9 years, yeah. But it was 9 years since...
Radical, big ups.
Thank you.
How the heck did that person get in?
I don't know who that is.
Oh, I see. Greg is on another line that's not marked. Okay. So, no, that doesn't make sense. I don't understand it. I'll see if this mutes you, Greg. Okay, whistle, Greg. All right. Now whistle, Greg. Greg, I don't know how Sarah's getting through.
How am I getting through?
But you know. What is that, Sarah? How'd you do that?
I am now a host.
Uh-oh.
But I know.
Goddamn host. How did she get up there? Yep. Did I put... I have to mute her. Okay.
So Sarah is
the host. How did she get up there? Okay, great. Typical stuff that you used to put up with, glitches and things. Okay. Now, a Robert Hensley from Cleveland came in, and he hung up. So, did he get the wrong show? Is he upset with Greg? Did he remember Greg? Greg, weren't you in Cleveland at one point, Greg?
I did live in Cleveland. I lived in Cleveland. I did. I lived in Cleveland between 1976 and 1977, and then between 1987 and 1998, I owned a home in Cleveland. And I traveled on it. That was like my cottage. I had a home on Lake Erie.
Right. And then you went to L.A. in 94 or so.
94, yeah, that's right, and through 95. Yeah. But I didn't.
Right.
But I still had the house in Cleveland.
Yeah, now they give some bona fides, I think that's how you say it, for Greg. And Greg was a cartoon animator prodigy. He got scouted at the age of 16 or 17 and was shipped off to London and missed his late adolescence, missed his college world, never got laid, and but he met all the Gregs in animation, which was probably more important, right, Greg?
Well, I'm having second thoughts about all of that now, but it's a bit too late.
You're having second thoughts because of where we've gotten?
It is encouraging that Donald Trump is able to get sort of porn stars and things like that at age 60. That's an encouraging thing, but I don't know.
You're saying that maybe you shouldn't have.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah, no, so you're saying at this late stage, you are maybe regretting that you had a talent for animation and were hijacked. Is that what you're saying?
Sincere about this. I'm glad I did what I did when I did. I got to do things that I would never have been able to do ever. And
your
I got to meet
like
people.
Yours.
And I got to meet people and work with people. And I had a very interesting career in doing something that I enjoyed. And that kind of work they don't really do anymore. You can do it. You can do it, but you'd be doing it as sort of a... It's like what my mom said. My mom said, that's more of a hobby, isn't it? Well, at the time that I did it, it was a job. But now it's more like a hobby. It would be more like a hobby.
Right. Now, what the heck got you into... since I never had any creative skills when I was a kid, and I was in Europe, so we had a different, less media environment. But I never understood why kids got into cartoons or anything. I just played sports. Why would you get into cartoons? Like, what causes it? Or is it just natural for a kid to like comic books?
Well, I didn't really... It's interesting, the two things, combine the two things. I wasn't all that crazy about comic books. I mean, I liked the covers of a comic book because they were generally well-drawn. The comic books, I wasn't that crazy about. That wasn't too interesting to me. It's hard to say why... I mean... I don't know why I was so interested in it.
Isn't
I thought about that.
Do sports and so you spend a lot of time by yourself. Is that the rule for you?
I guess I did have. I mean, I'll tell you something. This is my thought about it, and I don't want to bring the whole. I don't want to bring everybody down. But I think that maybe my life at home. I was an only child, and I wasn't really lonely. But I think that there was a tense atmosphere in the house. The relationship maybe between my mother and my father, maybe it was a bit tense. And I think that I thought that, I mean, I'm guessing here, but that I thought cartoons were funny. And that if everybody kind of got involved with something that was funny and was distracted by something that was funny, that it'd be better for everybody. And
therapy.
You know, if we're laughing, if we're laughing, we could forget about our troubles, you know? And we could, so I think maybe that was why I was fascinated by, at first, I think, I was fascinated by Popeye. And Popeye is a strange character. And, but there were, he looked, to me, what was fascinating is he looked like he was real. But I knew he wasn't real. And that's something, you know, to me, it's strange. I mean, I knew it was a draw. I think I knew it was a drawing, but it wasn't a drawing because it was moving. And he turned and he looked like he was real. And I think that fascinated me. And he lived in a, and he, at times he'd be in these environments that they constructed for the cartoons. Every so, like for the most part, he'd be against a flat background, you know, a watercolor background. But sometimes they build these massive great, like sets, like little tiny miniature sets that would be in three dimensions. And they would, technically, they place the cells up against this diorama that was going on in the back. And so then Popeye, who I thought, well, he's a drawing, but he looks real, he'd actually be interacting with real things. And I thought, this was fascinating. And remember, I saw all this in black and white. Like, a lot of the Popeye cartoons were in black and white, but some of them were in color, but we saw everything in black and white. So
yeah.
I was very fascinated by it. And then, of course, then with Bugs Bunny, and of course, these were cartoons that were made well. You know, they were done with a lot of care and attention, and they were funny. You know, they were, and you could aspire when you were a child watching those, because as a child you only see it on a certain level. But if you see that cartoon in a year or two again, you look at it differently because you start seeing things in it that you never really noticed before, because it's constructed on multiple levels of understanding. And there are things cartoons that I saw when I was a child that I saw when I was in my early 30s, and I went, oh, I had no idea that was what that meant. You know, what that, like, I'll give you an example. I don't know whether you know these characters, but in Warner Brothers cartoons, there's these little gophers, and they're called Mac and Tosh, all right? Now, this is kind of a takeoff on Chip and Dale, but these are little gophers. They live underground, and they're extremely polite to one another. Like, even if they're in danger, you know, and they're escaping somewhere, they'll go, oh, no, 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 after you. Oh, no, 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 I wouldn't think about it. After you. Oh, thank you. You know, and so, anyway, I've seen this, you know, these are familiar characters to me, seen them, you know, hundreds of times, even though they only made a few cartoons, you see them over and over again. And then one day I was sitting at my house, and I was watching one of these. I'm in my late 20s, early 30s or something, and I go, oh, they're gay. Those are gay gophers. They're homosexual gophers. And it never dawned on me before. But they are. And there's this one, and, you know, just to, I mean, some people might say, oh, he's just saying that, or, you know, he's making that up. But there's one cartoon where the two gophers, their tree's been chopped down and taken to a factory where they make things out, consumer items out of trees. And so they kind of go to the plant to get their tree back. And in the midst of being in this situation, they're in danger because of all the machinery that's involved. There are gags involving, the consumer society, you know, criticisms of consumer society and wastefulness in terms of natural resources and things like that. This is a cartoon made about 1953, 54. Anyway, one of the little gophers gets on a conveyor belt and is headed into kind of a wood chopper and his other little, you know, his homosexual friend, gopher, he sees him going, he tries to warn him, but the little guy thinks he's waving at him, so he's waving, and he goes through this machine, and the other little gopher's on the ground, goes, oh, no, he, like, he can't look, because, you know, he feels like the little guy's going to get chopped up. Anyway, he doesn't, and he's all discombobulated, this the character that's been through the machines, all discombobulated, comes down, and he's got these little wood shavings on his head, and it forms like a little, like hair, you know, like curled hair. And he comes down, and he's all, you know, confused, and everything, and he sings, "There was a little girl who had a little curl right in the middle of his forehead when she was good." And so the other little guy shakes him and says, "Snap out of it." He's slapping him. And he goes, I'm so sorry. He goes, "Look at this." He says, and the gopher who was down on the ground, who viewing this and who, you know, shook the little guy with the curly hair, he goes, "There's a time and a place for everything." And I mean, I thought,
awesome.
That was when I saw. I thought, this is a subversive message in a cartoon. You know, it's like they're saying, you know what, these two are gay, but we can't say they're gay, so we're gonna do this gag. And
yeah,
and it escaped me until I was in my early 30s. I didn't really get it. But so
what's the point? If it doesn't work with little kids, what do the brainwashers think they're doing? I mean,
well, they're people who made it, some of whom I actually met and worked with.
Yeah, you did become gay, right? It did work in the long run.
So they're putting things in that are amusing to them. As adults, so, yeah, they're doing things, but they're going, you know, we're not going to do something that's going to be, you know, noticeably offensive, because then we won't get away with it, right? So they're thinking,
yeah,
how can we do this where someone would be sort of embarrassed to take offense with it, because it'd be revealing more about them than it would be about the film itself. And so the guy who wrote this, his name was Warren Foster. He introduced a lot of subversive things into some of the cartoons he made or he wrote. And I heard stories about it because I worked with people who'd worked with him. He died in the mid 60s. But they said what he would do is he'd go into his room and he'd be drawing, you know, these gags up. And he'd just be giggling all the time. You know, they'd pass his room and he's like giggling to himself. You know, so you have to amuse you. If you're even thinking about amusing an audience, you have to amuse yourself. And when I watch children's television today, I can't imagine how anybody would be amused creating except to think that they're talking down to children. The cartoons weren't really specifically made for children. They were made for a general audience to be seen in a cinema, and they ended up being children's fodder on TV, you know, for people like me. And but that's why the best of the cartoons, just by the nature of their being made the way they were, work on a variety of different levels. And I'd watch them when I was a kid with my dad, and sometimes I wouldn't understand what was, like, why they said what they said. And my dad, who was clever, you know, knew a lot of stuff, like, I said to him, "Well, why did Bugs Bunny say that? What does that mean?" And he'd tell me. But he knew what it meant, and it was obscure. It was an obscure thing that
the cartoonist put in.
It was topical. Like, it was topical from 1948, and my father happened to know what it was. My father was English, but this is the gag. Bugs Bunny is involved with a gorilla, and it's about organ grinder monkey, and the organ grinder monkey goes and complains about Bugs Bunny to the gorilla in the zoo. The gorilla in the zoo breaks out and is going to go like beat up Bugs Bunny. And Bugs Bunny, meanwhile, is taking over the organ grinder monkey job, and because he thinks that's a good way to get money. So anyway, at the end of the cartoon, Bugs Bunny uses the gorilla to go and terrorize the people of this apartment building and smashing their windows to get money. And so, because the gorilla is so fearsome, and he's got control over the monkey through the organ grinder music. And Bugs Bunny says at the end of the cartoon, this is the end gag of the cartoon, Bugs Bunny says, "I sure hope Petrillo doesn't hear about this." Now, I'm sure you don't know what he's talking about, and neither did I. But my father knew that Petrillo was the head of the musicians' union in New York.
Wow.
And they went on strike, and Bugs Bunny's basically saying, hey, I might be violating the musicians' union. I mean, that's a pretty obscure gag to be in a cartoon.
Yeah.
1948, I'm seeing in, you know, 20 years later, I had no idea what that meant until my dad explained it to me. So it's there's always something interesting in them, you know. But as time went on, people went, oh, don't put anything topical in it; it'll date it. You know, don't put anything adult in it. You know, it's too much for the kids, or you know. And you end up with really bad television, really bad shows that aren't that are not interesting to watch on any level for anybody.
This is a good example of the arcane knowledge that average citizens, not that you're average, Greg, but you're a citizen, has. I mean, this evokes so many different moods, this cartoon talk, because it's part of our media diet, you know, through the decades. I never watched Saturday morning stuff, but I did see cartoons when I came over here in the 50s, and what you're talking about, a lot of black and white stuff, but you got to meet your heroes in animation. Who is the one that would, like, be the Zappa for me? Who is the genius? Were there too many geniuses, or was there one that really would impress you?
Well, when I was you don't know. You see people's names on a screen. That's how I started piecing it all together. At a very young age, I mean, I started noticing the names and forging the time, you know, I see the date of the cartoon, and you know, I started to know a lot about, you know, which artist worked at what time and for which director, and
how old were you when you did this?
Well, I was piecing that together when I was maybe 8-9 years old. Well, by the time
internet,
I was
there were no
cartoons. No, there was no internet.
There was no hit parade, like there was Hit Parade or Teen Music magazine. There was no cartoon magazines, were there?
No.
About the industry.
No. The information, it was only about Walt Disney. If you looked in the encyclopedia, animation would be Walt Disney. That was it. They wouldn't even discuss any of these other, you know, what they considered to be arcane people that were following sort of in Walt Disney's footsteps. So you wouldn't hear anything about Warner Brothers or, you know, and Hanna-Barbera was a big thing at the time, so you might see things about them because they were big in the late 50s or 60s, you know, doing television animation. And they'd done Tom and Jerry before that. But, yeah, it was getting information was extremely difficult. And thus...
But you put it together. You started to memorize the names. Remember.
Well, I would memorize the names, and also, let's say my parents were going shopping and there was a library nearby, I'd say, oh, can I go to the library while you go shopping? So I go to the library and I go to a reference section and I try and find any book that I could find about film or addresses of film people and all that. Of course, when I was a kid and I saw these cartoons and I see somebody's name from 19...
The conference is now locked.
On a cartoon.
Wait, just got knocked out. Say that last sentence again. You go to the library. When you were
young. I would go to the library, and I would go to the reference section, and I'd find technical volumes about film or, you know...
The conference is now unlocked.
Can you hear me, Bob?
We're playing with our locking. Is that stupid Sarah? We got to delete Sarah. Bill, Black, do something to Sarah. Anyways, back to you, Greg. So you go to the library looking at technical books.
Yeah, and I'd find, I've seen these cartoons and seen names from 1930, and I figure these people have to be either dead or really old now, right? Because I'm only, 11 or 12 years old by this point, 10, 11. But lo and behold, these people were very young when they started. So they were in their middle age by, at that time, getting, in their 50s or something, and they were still working. And I'd find addresses for them, and I'd to the people I really liked, I'd write a letter to them. And more often than not, they'd write back. Because they'd kind of be shocked that a kid would know who they were. You know, they said, we're used to getting letters for Bugs Bunny and replying, you know, about Bugs Bunny. But we don't get letters to us. You know, the people who make them. That's very, very unusual. You know? And they said, well, you know, it's very unusual that a child, you know, a kid would know certain cartoons we made or, you know, have the kind of interest in your show. It's very unusual. And they like, it'd be very common letters. They'd say, hey, I'm going to send this letter to this other famous person, you know, because they won't believe it.
So they tell you that. That's what
they
tell you.
They say, I'm sending your letter over to, like, because I, you know, if I wrote to somebody, I'd say, well, I like these people's work too. I like this. I like that. I like this cartoon. I like particular film. You know, and because these are all kind of lofty ages. I don't know what I exactly wrote to them, but they'd write back and they'd sort of be bewildered that someone even knew who they were. And through these more technical books, I guess, I got sort of a little bit more of an insight into it. And actually, it was at the library that I found a book. It was a British film almanac. And inside of it, it showed this man named Richard Williams, who was who I'd heard of, who was a director of animation in England. And sitting beside him was this older man by the name of Ken Harris. And I go, Ken Harris? I go, that's a really familiar name. And when I went home, I saw that he was an animator for the director, Chuck Jones, Charles M. Jones, also known as Chuck Jones. And I go, wow, that guy's over in England working with Richard Williams? I go, that's amazing. So I fired off a letter to that guy. And ironically, you know, I mean, I ended up working there alongside these two people, you know, I'll tell you something.
How did you impress them? How did you make animation? Why did they think you were good enough to get hired at 17? What did you send them?
Well, actually, the letter I wrote to Ken Harris in England, I'll tell you, I don't know whether this is an interesting story or not, but I'll tell it. When I got the job over in England, and I'll tell you how I got the job, but when I finally got the job, one of the little tasks that I was given to do that I guess nobody else wanted to do, or they wanted to pass it down to a newcomer, it was making stats, which is like making copies, right? But you do it with in a dark room with an enlarger, and it was all sort of a wet process, right, with photo paper and things like that. We didn't have a photocopy machine that could do enlargements or reductions or anything like that. All had to be done by hand. And so I learned how to do this, but at night I found that at night I would go in there on my own, and because I discovered this pile of negatives in there that had some things that looked interesting that I thought I might want to have for reference. So I went in and I started making copies of these things from negatives that were there, contact negatives. And anyway, and some of them were model sheets that Chuck Jones had done, a rare drawings I'd never seen before, that he'd left over there, because Chuck Jones, the animation cartoon, the American Warner Brothers animation director, had done business with Richard Williams over in England and so on. Anyway, I found this drawing. You know, I made this stat. I couldn't tell what it was when it was in negative form. I made it into a positive, and I'm looking at it, and it's a drawing of Daffy Duck or something. And I go, wow, what a terrible drawing. Why is this drawing in here? Who did this drawing? And then it hit me. I go, that's my drawing. That was the drawing I sent to Ken Harris. And they made a stat of it. And isn't it interesting? I maybe sent it to him when I was 12 or 13 years old. Now I'm 17 years old, and I'm looking at a drawing I did a few years ago, and I'm looking at it, not recognizing at first that it was mine, and also going how terrible it was. You know? And it was a bit of a wake-up call for me, you know? But anyway, how did I get the job? Well, because of my letter writing to people, only people I liked, you know, only people whose work I really liked, I wrote to them. I didn't write to everybody. Not that it's an honor that I write to anybody, but you know, that was, so anyway, and some letters would sort of go astray in a funny way. And I'd end up communicating with people that I hadn't originally intended to communicate with. They were associated with the people that I'd written to, but weren't those people. But it was fine and very good. And then they knew the other people I was communicating with, and they'd be on the same street, like working on the same street, and would bump into one another, and they'd tell me they'd have discussions about me on the streets of Hollywood. You know, what are we going to do with this kid? How are we going to get him involved in the business? Right? So all these people all knew that, you know, I was a topic of conversation. And meanwhile, I just carried on. I was making my own films and in Super 8 millimeter and in 16 millimeter, which is a big deal.
You were sending that to them?
Well, what happened was, I won a contest on National Educational Television, which is what later became PBS.
Yeah.
And I entered the contest from Canada to an affiliate of National Educational Television in Buffalo. And I won third prize in Buffalo, which then went on to the Nationals, and I won second prize all over America. So this cartoon that I made called, the title was, "And the Slobs Shall Inherit the Arts."
So, the Slobs shall inherit the arts.
The slobs shall inherit the arts.
The slobs shall inherit the arts.
And heard of this. I don't know whether you've heard of this director.
Oh, that's your brother.
That's my mother. Hold on.
Yeah, you can talk to her, Greg. Talk to her.
Okay, I'll put her on speaker.
Yeah.
Hi, Mommy.
Gregory, is everything all right?
Yeah, everything's fine. I just wanted to tell you that I hope you agree to this, but I'm talking with a man named Bob Dobbs. He's in Hawaii, and it's sort of an internet radio show he does.
Yes.
And so I'm talking with him now. You can say hello to Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Did you hear that?
This is Duffel. Hello. Billy Gillespie.
Anyway, yeah. So now my mother's in Victoria, and have you anything to say, Mom, about the world situation at all? Just
no, I haven't anything to say.
No.
Except whatever deals with you.
Oh, okay. Well,
hey, Greg, ask her if she's proud of your cartoon youth and how you get a job. Ask her what she thought of it.
Mom, Bob wants to know, what are your feelings about when I was a boy and interested in animated cartoons, and what did you think of it then, and what do you think of it now?
Well, I was surprised that you were so taken up with it. And always in the back of my mind was the fact that you would have to go to university.
Now, I never did go to university, did I?
No, you didn't.
And did that disturb you?
And all you wanted me to know?
Yeah.
Well, I was worried that you should get your education first and then go on to the other.
Yeah. Okay. I mean,
it worked out okay.
Now, I got to work with some pretty interesting people, didn't I?
I beg your pardon?
I got to work with some pretty interesting people, don't you think?
Yes, you did.
And I made a little bit of money along the way, don't you think?
Yes, you did.
And probably if I'd spent time going to university to get caught up with that, I might never have got involved in animation at all.
No, I don't think you would.
Yeah. So
would have been too occupied with the rest of it.
Yeah. So when did you notice that I first started to like cartoons?
Oh, very early.
Yeah. And what would I say about them, or what was my impression of them at the time?
Well, your whole life became the cartoons once you got used to them.
Yeah? What did I like the most as a young child?
You liked, well, I can't think that far wrong. At first it was what? Can't you remember what you were...
Well, I'm going to prompt you, but Popeye?
Beg your pardon?
Popeye.
Popeye, yeah. Popeye.
That seemed to be the thing I was most interested in at first.
I think so, yes. And then you got away from that to something else. I can't remember what it was.
Well, Bugs Bunny.
Bugs Bunny, yes.
And, well, they took Popeye off television in Canada in 1966 because Judy LaMarche said it was too violent. It's true. Do you remember Judy LaMarche, Bob?
Yes, I remember her.
Anyway, Mom, I'll let you go.
Yes, I'll talk to
thank you
tomorrow then.
All right, and Bob, thanks you, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
I just wanted to tell you, I don't know whether you know about this thing that's coming in from space.
What is it?
It's, what is it? It's called a space junk.
Space junk?
It's supposed to come in soon. When is it? It's within the next couple of days, I think.
Oh, yeah, so it could hit any of us at any time.
End up in Ontario.
Oh, that's narrowing it down to Ontario. Okay. Well, we'll see. I hope it doesn't crash through the ceiling.
It
has a lot of damage. Well, Mama, hopefully Ontario's big enough it'll be able to accommodate the junk.
Ion will protect Greg now that he's on the show.
Take care of yourself.
All right, Mommy. I'll see you later.
Bye.
Wow, that was amazing.
Hey, that was awesome, Greg. One of the great, that was one of the greatest hits of Dobb's radio career. You remember the little kid?
Anyway, what?
Greg, hold it, Greg. Remember Sean, his mother called in on Mike and Bob's show and told him to get back to bed?
Yeah, that was great.
Station ID for years.
That
Greg,
was great.
Sean, get off the phone. It's 12:45 in the morning.
His obsession was not Popeye. His obsession was you.
Right. So you tell your mother when you talk tomorrow that Bob says you're okay. You're on this show. Therefore, Ion protects you.
All right.
And then you can explain Ion to her.
Yeah, I can't remember where we left off there, but I. I won that prize in a film.
You won. I guess we were talking about the contest. Yeah, how you got to England.
So you
won the contest or came second.
Yeah. Yeah, and then in the meantime, I'd made a longer film, a 6-minute film, in color, all with cells and backgrounds and sound and everything. It was quite, I mean, when I look back, it's quite an ambitious project to do that. And I sent a copy of it out to California to one of these guys who was talking with other people on the street about getting me out there. And it just so happened that he knew this man, Richard Williams. Mm. And because they were both Canadians. And he was doing business out there with him. And he showed Richard Williams my film, and Richard Williams sent a letter to me and said, drop everything, come to England.
And you were 17, well, like in grade 11, 12?
I was finishing grade 12, yeah.
That would be the
so
end.
I finished,
you could drop
I
everything.
I finished grade 12. I would have gone on to grade 13 in Ontario at the time. And...
Right.
And then I finished that, and then like 2 weeks later, I flew to England.
Okay, so you finished grade 13 too?
No, I finished 12.
Right, so 12. How quickly, when he told you to drop anything, are you there within 2 months?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So how did you get an apartment? Like, you know, you're in London. It's the middle of the swinging London. It's the Beatles London, Rolling Stones. Pretty exciting time. Is that right?
It was a bit of a depression going on there at the time.
Yeah, this is what caused the punks. So if you were born in 55, 56, 76, 74.
73. It was 73.
Yeah, that's when America, when Britain was in a real slump, because the punks came out of that poverty.
Right. It was very depressing there.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I was fine. I was doing what I was doing, but people were depressed because I think the United States had depressed their economy, right?
Yeah,
I was deep in the middle of the oil crisis. Absolutely. I mean,
right.
That was really an
experience. You got an apartment with an English landlady or something.
No. What happened was, when I knew I was going to live there, my grandmother was still alive. And between, you know, basically preparing to go over there, getting the job, and the time of going there, my grandmother died. And anyway, I ended up living in her house with her third husband. Because he had no rights to live in the house. My grandmother had made sure that he didn't get her house. He didn't somehow. You know, the house went to my father and his sister. But they agreed to let him live in the house as long as he could. And I ended up living there with him. He was 81 years old. And he went to work every day at a tank factory. You know, not building tanks, but did some accountancy work or something. And he was still working and would drive off to work every day. And so I lived with this 80-year-old man. And I'd go off to work every day. I lived in a place called Woking, which is about 26 miles from London. And I'd go in and take about 30 minutes to get the train in, because it was on a fast line into London. And I'd pass the Parliament buildings every day and go into Waterloo Station and go about three stops on the tube to Tottenham Court Road and Oxford Street. And the studio was right around there in a place called Soho Square.
Wow, is that where is Rob from? Rob's in Tottenham, right? Yeah, our regular Rob guy, the animator of London, he's listening right now. He lives in Tottenham. Is that what you're saying, Tottenham Court?
Well, this is called Tottenham Court Road.
Oh.
But I don't know whether it's in Tottenham. Like,
right.
Tottenham's a different place. But, I commuted in. But during the oil crisis, the trains all shut down through strikes and things like that. And so the studio paid for one of the guys at the studio to sort of put me up at his place. And I lived in London for a little while with him and his girlfriend. And, mainly what I was doing there, I'd go to work and then I'd go home I'd work on a little assignment, animation assignment. So it was almost, you know, a lot of the time I was involved really intensively in learning about animation and doing animation. And it was very intensive, more intensive than any.
Did they regard you as a good investment? Did you live up to their expectations?
I don't know. I mean, I hope so. I mean, to a certain extent. I mean,
how long were you there?
I was there for a year and a half.
Yeah.
And
Why would you leave?
You know, and it was a strange. It was just time to go. It was. I think it's hard to it's hard to go through all the things that went on at the time. It wasn't like a friend of mine. One of my there was sort of you end up with factions in anything.
Yeah.
In politics, in life, in working, and. I was sort of involved with a faction that liked cartoons, that liked animation. And one of my friends was, I don't know, just sort of unhappy there, and I guess I became sort of, I'd learned a lot, and I wanted to do more, and so it just worked out that I left, and
so there it is, people. Greg's always had a problem with management. He did it in England.
I guess
started in London.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, well, the thing is, we're working on the. Well, here's the thing. Imagine this. I went over there and was told that I was going to be working on a feature film. Now, it really didn't matter what I was going to be working on, but there was all this talk about working on a feature film. And this feature film, it didn't, you know, there was work on, it had been, this film had been worked on for about eight to 10 years before I got there. Really? And Ken Harris, this animator, Warner Brothers animator, who was in his 70s, he had done the bulk of the work on it. And this guy was a top animator. I mean, really, top guy.
Yeah.
And he would go over there during the summer, he'd go over to England, and he'd work for 3 months during the summer and in the fall, and he'd go back to England. And
he'd go back to LA.
Go back to Los Angeles. And he'd go to Wimbledon. He was a big tennis guy, and Dick Williams lured him over by getting him tickets for Wimbledon. So he'd come over, go to Wimbledon, and then he'd go to work, right? And they paid him, you know, they paid him a fee. And so, anyway, they kept talking about this film and this, you know. Anyway, it got a bit wearing, and there was a lot of tension about this thing and about whether it's going to get done or whether it's going to get started or what's going to happen. Anyway, now fast forward 22 years, all right?
Yeah.
22 years, I'm in Los Angeles, and that film is finally released. 22 years later. And that film, Richard Williams, who was the director of that film, he had been taken off the film. They had to finish the film without him because he was never going to get it done. You know, it was like his life's work that he never wanted to let go. And they actually took the film away from him, and then they started, you know, made it in their own image and kept bits of his, had to make all new bits and spread it all over the world to Taiwan, to, you know, Russia, to, you know, Canada, everywhere, America, anywhere to get this thing done. And it was called a completion bond problem, right? It was an insurance problem because basically the film was supposed to be released. When it doesn't get released, then the insurance company has to pay back the distributor for its trouble, and then it's left with the film, the assets of the film. And then they have to sort out how to get it made. Anyway, it was just a fiasco. So, and
what's the film?
So it was called, originally, well, it had so many different titles. It was eventually, it was released in America called Arabian Night or Arabian Night. Honestly, I can't remember what the title was. It was changed so many times. And it was a real hodgepodge. You know, some parts of it are absolutely amazing. I mean, they're just incredible to watch. I mean, an amazing spectacle. And then there are other bits that are just terrible, you know, that were done at the end in a rush.
Yeah.
So I think partly what it was back then was I could see this, even at 18 years old, I could see that this was a disaster, you know, with all the good intentions maybe that they had. It looked like an almighty disaster. I try to avoid, you know, as much as possible, being involved in sort of fruitless disasters, you know? I mean,
Greg, I looked up, there's an Arabian Nights 2013 director, Chuck Russell, is that it?
No, hold on, I'll find it for you. It's called, okay. The director's name is Richard Williams, and the film is The Thief and the Cobbler. That's what it was called. I think it was The Thief and the Cobbler. The Thief and the Cobbler. It was released.
It's animated.
Yeah, I get. Yeah, animated. Thief and the Cobbler, and
we're
it was.
Here.
I think it was released under a different title in America, but let me see.
Well, there's a Thief trailer, 1995, but then
yeah, that's
uploads,
it.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
You see, Carol,
that's it.
In my memory, I remember that title in the New York subways.
Uh-huh.
We were in New York then, and that sounds familiar. I saw posters. Unless there was not that title. But that title
It was called The Thief and the Cobbler, and then I think it was called Arabian Night or something. Anyway, it was a sort of an unmitigated disaster, which...
Greg, they say Vincent Price was in it and Matthew Broderick and Jennifer Beal. So, I mean, they're...
Vincent Price recorded his lines in the early 1970s. Because by 1995, Vincent Price had died, I think. Matthew Broderick was brought in at the, you know, I don't think Richard Williams hired Matthew Broderick at all. And Jonathan Winters was involved, too, later on, because he dubbed a bunch of stuff. It was nothing like what Richard Williams wanted it to be, but, you know, he'd been fired, and it was just a mess. But
amazing.
Yeah, and
was your part in it? How many seconds were you in the film, or was your?
I saw things when I was watching. Like, a lot of stuff was cut out. A lot of amazing stuff that I knew about from having worked there never made it into the final American cut.
Mm-hmm.
but the finished film, as it was, when I went to the cinema in Los Angeles, I saw it in Los Angeles, and I did see things that I'd worked on, you know, that I'd been in. I was an in-betweener on it. Ken Harris did this character called the Thief. And he was concentrated mainly on this particular character. And it was a character that didn't speak. And he sort of went around stealing things and doing different things. His whole motivation was to steal. And evidently, Ken Harris's brother had worked in Saudi Arabia. And he told Ken Harris, he says, you know, when you're in, there are all these flies. Flies are surrounding you all the time. So Ken Harris told this to Dick Williams, and Dick Williams says, oh, we'll have flies around the thief all the time. So one of the jobs that some of us assistants and in-betweeners had to do was to animate the flies around the thief's head.
Yeah.
So I was given a scene to do of these flies. So you're given the animation of the cartoon character, and then you animate the flies around the head. And mm-hmm. So in one of the scenes that I did, the thief, the character, ran off screen, and the fly sort of delayed a little bit and then followed him, but then one was left behind. I left one behind. And then it carried off after him. Anyway, I just did it as a gag. You know, I had autonomy to do it, and I just did it because I thought it'd be funny. Anyway, they ran it in the what we call the rushes, And we're all sitting down watching these pencil tests of these things. And the scene I did where I animated the flies comes on. And it gets a huge laugh. You know, amongst everybody working at the studio, because they've never seen this. Like, there's never been a gag with the flies before, right? So, anyway, Richard Williams sits there and goes, wow! Like, he put his glasses up on his head and he goes, wow! That's good! And then he goes, we're gonna do that in every scene! And you should
let's overdo it right away.
But not only that, but you should have seen the looks everybody, all the people who were had done scenes of this, they gave me such dirty look because they're going, you're the one that's going to have us have to get back in and reanimate every one of those scenes to put in that idea.
Right.
Wow.
So I was like persona non grata there for a while. because they used to think, the other guys used to think it was funny. They'd say, oh, you know, we had the fly, you know, because they color code the little flies, right? To make sure, because it had to be perfect. And they said, oh, we had one of them go in his ear and then out the other ear, things like that. And I thought, nobody's going to notice that. You know, so I thought, I'm going to do something somebody's going to notice. And I'm going to put a little gag in here. So,
wow, amazing.
Fun.
So you leave. Now, you could go on. Maybe you'll be on again soon. We can continue this parallel story because I want to bring it up to the person who listened to Bob Marshall and got fascinated with Dave Emery and Babe Russell, all this stuff. What is in the Toronto personality of you attracted to you to that kind of information?
Well, I think for a period of time when I was really, really involved in animation as a young boy, you know, if I ever became a man, I'm not sure whether I ever did. But I was a bit apolitical, somewhat apolitical. Not really, you know, more interested in animation than politics, although I must have had an interest in it all the way along. Because I was sort of brought up in a kind of not a political family, but like we talked about things, right? And it was a sort of a left wing, we call it, I guess, quote unquote, family. And
underground or counter, not the norm.
Yeah.
You were
right. Where you're, you know, I mean, I remember going campaigning for the NDP with my mom when I was, I don't know, 6, 7 years old. And, I mean, people would be yelling at us when we go campaigning during the election. You know, say, you filthy communists, you reds, you know. I mean, really hostile people, you know. In a very looking tough area, you know. And I was just very shocking. And I guess it made me a little strident towards those kind of people. But anyway, because they were just so mean. So, anyway, but when I, by the time I would have been listening to you and Mae Brussel and things that you brought to CKLN, which started in 1983, there was no sort of quote-unquote underground.
84.
You started in 84. CKLN started in 83. And
yes.
I listened to it because it was a bit more eclectic. You know, it had stuff on. I mean, like they play, I was into Prince, and they played Prince, but not the hits, you know, things that would sort of tracks they wouldn't play on regular radio. So,
right.
And other things. And they had political things on there too, to a certain extent. So that was interesting. Then one Saturday morning, and I had my own studio by this point. This is right around the time that I start my own animation studio with my late wife, Mary. We started our own studio, and on Saturday mornings, I'd have the radio on, and I started hearing this woman, Mae Brussel. And I thought it was one of the most amazing things I'd ever heard. You know, and she was saying things that I'd postulated about, or just things that I loved hearing, you know, her, like, trashing Reagan and all those, Alexander Haig and all these people. I just thought, wow, this is fantastic. this is great. Who is this woman? And I think there were clips of only maybe 10 minutes of her. It wasn't a whole hour-long thing. It was very short. And I really liked it and wanted to hear more, but there was no way of knowing when it would occur except if you tuned in at the same time the next week. But I guess I listened enough to it that when it sort of transmogrified to other places on the schedule, you know, I might, by happenstance, hear it. And then, then the international connection would come on Sundays, and I would, I'd often.
In 85, 86, Mike Dyer had the Friday night overnight slot, and he would play a whole hour of Mae Bressel.
You're right. You know what? I remember I was doing in 86, I think it was. We were just we had so much work that I had to get in a hotel downtown just to get a few hours sleep to keep going. And I remember I was at the hotel at around 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And I turned the radio on, and Mae Bressel was on, much to my surprise.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, oh, this is where they're hiding her now, you know? And
So that started it. Mae Bressel was your virginity. That was
then,
the beginning.
Then that of course led into the Dave Emery that was heard on Sunday mornings during the International Connection with Bob Marshall. So I was a dedicated listener to that. And, you know, really, this was, I think, maybe what people should know about this. And I was talking to Daniel about this just this past week. What you did by bringing these shows from Southern California or Northern California, wherever they were done, by bringing them and redistributing them, it was novel. I mean, today people would go, oh, you know, they can listen. Well, look, they're listening to this thing, right, over the internet, and they can listen to radio all over the world, right? And so they think, oh, it must have always been that way. But no, like people like Dave Emery and Mae Bressel, they were doing things in a small little cocoon. What was done was you were doing what the internet did later,
by bringing
that information to Toronto and redistributing it. Really opened up my life, opened up my thoughts, Dr. Beter and all that stuff. I mean, whether you think it's ludicrous or whether you think it's serious or not, it doesn't matter. You know, it opens up your mind and it gets you thinking in a different way. You know, I mean, I organic laboratory. I mean, where would I be without the organic laboratory? I'd be nowhere. If that wasn't in my life, I don't know. I mean, I can't say what it's done for me, but I'd feel deprived if I didn't know about organic robotoids. And so everybody was listening, and they don't know about an organic robotoid.
And then never thought that you'd end up hosting the show.
No, that never dawned on me. Never. I never thought, I aspire to be a radio host. I remember I was out in Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles in the early 90s, and I was really big into Howard Stern.
Yeah.
A bit of a fanatic about it. And this woman who I was working with or working for out there, we were collaborating, our studio was collaborating with this other company out there, she says, you know, you should do a radio show. And I looked at her, I went, oh, come on. I said, I could never do that. And she was serious. You know,
Is that based on your personality? She was judging
your
personality?
I don't know, but I just dismissed it. I just thought, what a strange thing to say to me. You know, I'm an animator. I work on animated cartoons. Why are you saying I should be a radio host? Not that I thought that a bad thing to do. I just didn't think. I don't know, but I think she was serious about it in a way. I mean, she didn't, you know, there's nothing to do about it. I couldn't
immediately
become a
radio host.
Well,
maybe you were an interesting person. You were probably by then able to talk with Mae Bressel and Emery and all this stuff, you know, in passing. She probably thought you were a bit odd or unique enough to have an audience.
Maybe, yeah. And I mean, yeah, I guess so. But I liked what You know, I with you. I mean, actually, I first heard Howard Stern because of you.
Why?
Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, because one, I used to do is I'd record.
Oh, he played Howard Stern with
Zappa.
Right,
because of the Zappa thing, right?
Oh, wow.
I'd heard of Howard Stern, but you know, he's always deprecated, right? He's always a terrible person, a horrible human being, or whatever. And of course, there was no way to hear Howard Stern, really, because
right.
How would I hear Howard Stern? He's in New York, I'm in Toronto, you can't hear it, right? So
yeah.
Then I recorded.
I played that famous dialogue, Zappa and Stern. It's awesome. He talks about Bill Casey probably didn't die really. He had great conspiracy angles and everything. He just shot
the AIDS thing. The AIDS thing. Who blew the monkey?
The AIDS theory.
Remember who blooped the monkey? Is what I want to know.
Who blooped the monkey? The Surgeon General. What was his name? Carol probably wouldn't know. The Surgeon General, that weird guy.
So what I would do is I had a Betamax video recorder, and it could record for 4.5 hours in hi-fi audio, and I would set up for those. You know, 10 o'clock p.m. into, you know, through the night, shows that you did with Mike Dyer. I'd record them, and then the next day I'd go in and I'd listen to them while I was driving. And one of the shows, Kent, who came on after Bob and who was sort of under Bob's control, apparently.
Kent Perry.
He was like under a spell of Bob. He played the Howard Stern Frank Zappa thing, and I thought, wow, this is a really interesting show, a fascinating program to listen to. And that, so when I went out to Los Angeles and Howard Stern was on, I was doing work out in Los Angeles in the 1991, and he just happened to start there in 1991, syndicated. So I was big into that, you know. That was sort of my replacement Bob, because it's creative. You know, the thing is that the international or the show that you did with Mike Dyer was very creative, I thought.
Yeah. So, spontaneous.
Spontaneous. Yeah. I mean, but some of it appeared to be planned, but not. And you just couldn't tell. And it was really refreshing type of radio to hear. And I was really, but again, even though I knew that was being done in Toronto, I never thought, oh, I could get involved doing that. I never thought of that.
Right. Okay, so listen to this. One association I have with Howard Stern is in the early 90s, I was staying at Jerry Fialka, and he had the little cottage in the back, and the family that owned, the guy who owned the front, he'd sometime be out raking the leaves or something, and I got talking to him, and one day I brought up Howard Stern. He said, oh, I can't stand that guy. I said, why? He says, I would never express my personal life like he does. All my personal foibles, I wouldn't do that. And that always stuck with me. This archetypal guy, archetypal L.A. Los Angelino, all-American, normal guy, found Stern shocking because he talked so much about himself, you know, his personal habits or whatever. It always stuck with me.
It's interesting, isn't it, that when you notice what's happened in Los Angeles recently with all of these revelations.
Yeah.
People have...